Well, I think we're just about at that time to get started today. Welcome, everyone. Thank you all for coming to the Undergraduate Writing Symposium. And my name is Brent Chancellor. I'm a second-year MFA student in fiction. So I have a great love of writing. I worked at the writing studio previously, so I'm happy to be here today to introduce this panel. So the way this will work is our panelists will read, each will read from her work, and then we'll save some time at the end for questions. So hold your questions for everyone until the end, and I'll introduce each panelist between readings. So, but to introduce this panel, this is called On Loss and Longing. So loss and longing are two classic literary themes, and this panel will explore these themes through two poetry explications and an original work of short fiction. In her paper, The Labor of Lust, Alina Barry argues that a Wallace Stevens poem takes the counterintuitive perspective that rather than being erratic, lust is valuable and worth working for. Wen Ting Chen brings the issue of longing to life in a short story entitled The Undergraduates. In her paper, The Role of Voice in Man and Echo, Haley Carlin argues that W.B. Yeats' poem employs an ironic dialogue between man and his echo to show that controlling one's own voice can lead to internal conflict. So we'll start today with Elena Barry. Elena G. Barry is a human and organizational development first-year student who plans on declaring a second major in the history department in the near future. Elena writes music and cultural articles for Versus Arts and Culture magazine here at Vanderbilt, and has been writing in local newspapers of her hometown of Racine, Wisconsin since elementary school. Please welcome Elena Barry.
Thank you. The title of my essay is called The Labor of Lust. Across a crowded room, someone mysteriously floats through a sea of people, wearing a little number that flatters in every way possible. All eyes lock on this figure. An impassioned longing emerges for this elusive beauty. And so ends the cliche portrayed by many a melodrama. The desire fades as novelty runs thin. However, Wallace Stevens saw the value of lust. The perspective of his poem, Peter Quince at the Clavier, showcases desire as the product of work. Through his paralleled comparisons of sound and feeling, love and lust, Stevens looks at lust as an important attribute of life and just as valid as any other emotion. By using each section of the poem to create another vantage point on the issue of lust, the speaker presents a counterintuitive argument where lust is not merely the result of befuddled hormones. Lust is a feeling, but shown through the immense complexity of the poem, lust requires some effort. The true beauty of lust lies in the subtle intricacies that produce an overwhelming emotional response. The first section of the poem takes a first-person point of view on the speaker's personal account of desire by asserting that beauty of music lies in what is felt, not the actual notes articulated. The speaker takes this argument one step further by linking the feeling of music to desire, an inseparable bond that is the crux of the argument throughout the poem. As he sits at his piano, the speaker realizes that music is feeling then, not sound, and thus it is that what I feel, here in this room, desiring you. Lines 4 through 6. By making this comparison between the value of music and desire with some of the opening lines, the speaker connects desire to all the effort that one generally associates with creating a piece of music and the mastery of an instrument that is generally associated with performing a particular piece. The fact that the speaker is desiring her becomes as important of an issue as the music he is playing, if not more so. Before the speaker alludes to anything, he sets up a similar scenario seen in the aforementioned fictional party scene. The starry-eyed lovers across a crowded room, and all the magic that thereafter ensues. The magic that emerges is quite like the feeling that ensues after hearing a breathtaking piece of music. Both of those feelings are the results of tireless work. However, the speaker does not only seek to link music and lust together in this first section. He begins to demonstrate the complex nature of desire through the introduction of deterioration within language. The syntax moves from the straightforward end-stop lines to an enjambment that seems to mimic someone falling over himself. After desire is introduced, the speaker in this section turns to a fumbling hormonal pubescent, unable to express himself with the clarity he possessed only a few lines before. And thus it is that what I feel, here in this room, desiring you, thinking of your blue-shadowed silk, is music. It is like the string Waked in the Elders by Susanna, lines 5-9. The shifting of ideas between the lines portrays a scene where something terribly beautiful has shocked the speaker in such a way that he cannot form a coherent thought. However, the speaker is only seemingly bewildered. This complexity is not the result of confusion, but rather the strategic result of the labor involved in evoking the feeling of desire. Specifically through stopping one metaphorical line, thought midline, as in line 8, the speaker is showing that desire springs from a more organic place. It develops without regard to the sentence prior to or the statement following. Much like beauty and the feelings that emerge from it, the natural flowing of the lines disregards conventional structure without being haphazardly thrown together. Although desire develops in a more organic sense, the work is still apparent through the elaborate enjambment. As much as the first section was an ode to the speaker's personal desires for an unknown character, the second section serves to show the desire that was felt by the elders, while showing the complexity of that desire. The speaker moves from the disorientation of the first section to a calm, cool, and natural setting. The speaker takes an omniscient role as the master storyteller of Susanna's tale. Throughout this second section, and through the natural elements the speaker introduces, the internal rhyming lulls the reader into a state of relaxation. This relaxation parallels a relaxation of Susanna at a moment that most would find solace, a long bath. But this solace is abruptly interrupted by the speaker's mimicry of music, which represents the elder's lust. The story continues as Susanna feels a breath upon her hand, mute of the night. She turned, a cymbal crashed in roaring horns, lines 36-40. These lines reiterate the connection between desire and music, but also serve to cast some insight onto those that possess the lust that is crucial to the speaker's argument. These lines may represent the surprise Susanna felt upon discovering the elders. However, another interpretation could be that the cacophony of sounds more appropriately describes the lust of the elders, controlled, timed correctly, and powerful. Though the power and timing could have been demonstrated in a number of ways, the controlled aspect of these instruments coming in on cue as a result of a master orchestration is the real accolade to the elders. Lust is not a massive object crashing about to produce sounds. Rather, it is the regulative entrance of orchestral instruments. Although the second section presents desire as a product of some degree of control, the tone of the third section is so unbearably tight and restrictive that it stifles creativity and beauty, forcing the speaker to revert back to simple rhyme and even simpler actions. Still with an omniscient speaker, the view changes from the serene Susanna to the bustling Byzantines. In its neat couplets of elementary rhymes, the tableau is the anti-lust. The third section is a laundry list of actions, and foolhardy actions at best. In the most efficient way, the Byzantines came, line 42, wandered, line 43, whispered, line 45, revealed, line 48, and fled, line 50, quickly assessing the situation but coming to all the wrong conclusions. And after all their work, for actions are generally associated with work, all that the Byzantines really accomplished was falsely accusing a woman of being a temptress. The Byzantines, so concerned with the work to be done, are without passion, without emotion, and altogether unappreciative of the beautiful lust the speaker has worked to achieve. By criticizing the third perspective of the Byzantines as those only concerned with doing and not with feeling, the speaker shows the downfall of anti-lust, which is predictable, ignorant, and so obsessed with the work that it misses the point. This is not to say that the speaker does not appreciate the labors of life, but he does claim that when those labors become the focus, at the exclusion of emotions, beauty is lost. Cleverly juxtaposed, the third and fourth sections serve as polar opposites of one another, one embodying purely misconceived notions of the dark side of desire, and the other serving as an elegant accolade to all things beautiful. The point of view in this final section puts the embodiment of lust, the body, on a pedestal. Comparing the beauty of the body to the immortal holy grail of all things sacred, the speaker asserts that beauty is momentary in the mind, the fitful tracing of a portal, but in the flesh it is immortal. The body dies, the body's beauty lives. So evening died in their green going, a wave interminably flowing. Lines 51 through 56. At first glance, the context seems surreal. It is peculiar to think of the flesh as immortal, since it is generally the first thing to go as old age stealthily creeps in. However, the speaker is not referring to one particular body. These lines transcend the you mentioned in the first section, and even Susanna, the body to whom this poem is unofficially dedicated. The body serves as the embodiment of lust. As the body dies, or one lusty encounter fades, the body's beauty lives, just as the beauty of desire continues. The speaker transcends from an individual perspective of one moment of lust to collective feeling of desire that will continue through the course of human history. The reason beauty is immortal in the flesh is because lust is of the flesh, and as the speaker has shown in previous sections, one of the things that allows the beauty of lust to prove so powerful is the amount of work put into evoking such a response. Through the different perspectives of each section, the speaker creates a circuitous argument where the beauty of lust is discovered in its emotional response, and the reason for the emotional response lies in the work done to produce it. But the work must not be the focus, or the beauty of lust is lost. According to the speaker, lust is natural, lust is inevitable, and lust is just as valuable as things laboriously constructed by those who would rather write off lust than embrace it. The fact remains to be seen about the ill effects, or positive ones, of leaving the object of lust out of the equation. Perhaps, in the speaker's point of view, the importance of desire lies not in whom you desire, but what it feels like to desire. Just as the importance of music is not in the sounds played, but in the feelings evoked. This, and not a misogynistic outlook, could explain why the speaker treats Susanna as more of an object and less of a human. The speaker's overall goal is not to discuss the equity between men and women, nor is it to discuss the beauty of a woman's form as an attribute of the woman. The speaker's intention is to put lust on a proverbial pedestal, something he accomplishes with seeming grace and ease. However, in a poem with as many subtle nuances as Peter Quint's, it is also clear that the speaker believed in the necessity of work to elicit feeling, in other words, the labor of lust. The idea that lust is everlasting is a foreign one at best, but in the story of Susanna, and from the perspective of our speaker, the everlasting lust is an oft-overlooked aspect of what is beautiful and subsequently timeless. Thank you.
Next we have Wenting Chen, who's reading a short story called The Undergraduates. Wenting is a sophomore and a creative writing major, along with being pre-med. The paper that she'll read today is the first story that she wrote for a beginning fiction workshop. So please welcome Wenting.
Undergraduates. Here's to you, Mrs. Robinson. Jesus loves you more than you will know. Whoa, whoa, whoa. God bless you, please, Mrs. Robinson. Heaven holds a place for those who pray. Hey, hey, hey. Hey, hey, hey. Simon and Garfunkel.
I can't sing, so I read it.
The first time she met him, they were moving into the building at the beginning of the year. She and her mother, both laden with boxes, were going up the stairs just as he was coming down. And she remembered catching his eye as she shook her hair out of her face the best she could. Her bangs glazed to her forehead in the heat. She looked away just as quickly, though, as she had never been the friendly type. He's attractive, her mother said casually in Mandarin, eyebrows raised as they continued upwards. He turned around to look at you. She shrugged at this prompting. Her mother was unorthodox in this fashion, but she supposes there must be some pride in there somewhere. She remembers every Chinese New Year party where all the matrons would eye her with a twist in their lipstick and turn around to tell her mother how pretty her daughter is. The undersides of their words slipped in envy. That's nice, she said as she propped the cardboard boxes atop the railing, speckled with rust, so she could grasp the door handle. She quite liked the way he looked, though, so she's pleased by his acknowledgement, and she keeps in mind to look for him in the future. It's not so much that she has any interest in the boy himself. She just likes the possibility of being wanted. There's a restlessness that seizes her sometimes. It makes her tap her toes inside her flats, and it makes the soles of her feet itch for pacing, but it's nothing physical. This feeling gnaws at the inside of her chest the way anticipation does, an unreachable sensation buried in the lining of her lungs. Anticipation, however, is justified. This restlessness is comprised of a sense of impatience and the wild hope that something, anything, might happen. It's this particular feeling that makes her seek him out on occasion. In the beginning, she doesn't know him terribly well, but there's little hesitation because he lives in her dormitory on the floor below her, and it's convenient. Besides, she's always greeted with his brightly attentive look and easy smile that comprise the holy grail of attention whores everywhere. Sometimes they sit against the wall outside his room, a foot or so apart. His knees are pulled loosely toward his chest, while her long pale legs, presently wrapped in gray drain pipes, are sprawled across the hallway. As they pass a pint of chocolate ice cream back and forth, he tells her that he doesn't believe in God. She doesn't either, because her parents grew up under Mao Zedong, and after they moved to the States, she was told at 5 years old that only believers go to heaven. Considering her parents were rather emphatically atheists, she decided she'd rather be wherever her family was. Heaven be damned. She doesn't tell him this, though. She tells her that Asian girls are number 12 on the official list of what white people like. She exhales the laugh, her dark eyes crinkling at the corners. As the semester progresses, they migrate from the hallway into his room. He tells her about the time he took acid. The incident in question occurred not too long ago, on the night before they happened to have breakfast at adjacent tables, each with their respective group of friends. In fact, that was the morning she managed to slop an entire cup of orange juice down her front. So she's perversely grateful that he wasn't in a state to notice. He tells her about how he saw bright purple dots moving across the walls and how he freaked out a man and a woman when he pressed his face against the window of their car. He wasn't sure whether they were real or not. Apparently, he decided to try acid because he wanted to know if the things people said about it were true. "I'm not going to do it again, though," he tells her. "My family has a bad history with drugs." She takes this for what it is. In the soothing silence, she taps her fingers against her thigh and glances lazily around. An acoustic guitar propped up in a corner catches her eye. "I used to play," she tells him. He gives her a soft, inscrutable look and picks up the guitar. "Do you mind?" he asks. She shakes her head. He strums a few chords and begins to sing. His voice is rough and a bit breathless, but he's earnest enough and she's never been serenaded before. Later, she'll wonder if normal people go around trying to seduce other people with that particular Simon and Garfunkel song. However, at the time, she doesn't realize that he's trying to seduce her until he puts down his guitar, sidles over to her, and kisses her full on the mouth. She kisses back, if only because his actions are unexpected. "Not fair," she pouts after he slipped off her tank top. "How come I'm the only one with my clothes off?" He laughs. "You're welcome to take off my clothes," he says with a quiet grin. She leans down, propped up on an elbow to lick the curve of his ear, one hand holding back her long sheet of inky hair, the other reaching down to undo his belt. Afterwards, he lies with his back to her, and she picks up the peeling paint on the wall, minute flakes of pigment edging themselves beneath her nails. "He's cute," she thinks, an epithet applied to small dogs and pleasant children. She picks out her fingernails in turn, the flecks of pale green clashing against the remnants of her red nail polish. She hates this part. She can't fall asleep with somebody else there, especially not in a bed meant for one child, ages 12 and under. However, she's practical enough to know it'd be awkward to attempt to extract herself at the moment, so she waits. Like playing dead, she thinks, and rolls toward the wall, stealing another few inches of the covers. She sees him twice in the recent aftermath. Both times he blushes and shifts uneasily, and she simply stares because it makes no difference to her. After all, it's not her problem if he feels awkward. She doesn't expect to see him. She doesn't expect to see him much more after this, but he surprises her. A few weeks later, her friend tells her that the boy she slept with says hi, not that her friend knows that she did so. She tells her friend to say hi in return. The recipient of the greeting texts her one night to ask if she's doing anything. She makes an assumption and plans upon heading downstairs a while later. Her mother calls every night, asking about tests and homework and whether she's been eating. Presently, she responds that there's a biology test next Tuesday, and she's working on a paper for a literature class, and yes, she's been eating for once. She also reminds her mother that her little brother has a karate tournament on Saturday. "I have to go, Mama," she says as she takes a look at the clock. "I need to go to the library before it closes." She doesn't suppose her parents really care what she does, as long as she gets good grades, honors the family, and takes care of them in their old age. They don't ask about anything else, after all. They also did mention a few small facts that white people drum into their daughters, that a boy respects a girl more if she holds out. She doesn't care much for sex, really. It's just something that can be done or not done, like laundry. However, she's contrary enough when judged, and she needs to be noticed or she feels like she's wasted, a blank piece of paper crumpled and thrown away. Although she's hardly blatant in her occasional activities, she doubts that her parents are completely ignorant. She suspects that they simply rather not know, so she does her part to keep the pretense. She mentions her parents' apparent apathy to him as a theoretical idea as they sit on his bed side by side. "I don't think my mom cares either," he tells her, "as long as I don't get anyone pregnant." She raises an eyebrow at this. He grins cheekily and reaches over to tickle her. She tries unsuccessfully to squirm away, laughing with an odd combination of hysteria and delight coloring the noise. She discovers, however, that he's ticklish too, and not too much is said after that point. As they lay sprawled across each other, she notices the salon hair care products in a shower basket because she's on the side of the bed that isn't against the wall. "Tresemme?" she asks, smirking. He shrugs. "I didn't buy it," he tells her. She believes him but asks quite seriously if she can borrow his blow dryer sometime because he has a better one than she does. His straw-colored hair is always grooved with a certain insouciance and is long enough to brush the wire frames of his glasses when he's wearing them. Her head's tucked beneath his chin and she has her arm slung over his shoulder so she may reach the strands of hair that curl around his neck. It's an odd color, she thinks, as she winds her hair through it, too pale to be the matte yellow or the gold that characterizes most blondes. She always goes for the guys who are a little skewed of average, the ones who don't reek of wifehood and suburbia in the near future. She feels a bleary contentment as the clock tower strikes three muffled clanks in the distance. Her lashes brush his skin as she closes her eyes, his pulse warm against her cheek. He smells of expensive shampoo and unlit Marlboros. They breathe the silence in and out, his hand resting lightly on her lower back. "My father committed suicide when I was 9, he tells her softly in the dark. Shot himself in the head. He tells this in the same tone in which he conducts mundane pleasantries. But when she leans back to look at him, she sees that his blue eyes are hooded. She's not quite sure how to respond, so she squeezes his shoulder and kisses him on the corner of the mouth. A year later, she'll remember this when she's scrubbing egg crusts off the pan she used to fry her breakfast. Her hands will still beneath the scalding water, her right grasping the sponge with streams of white froth leaking away between her fingers. She'll realize that it's a secret, what he told her. She'll wonder if he ever told anyone else. Then she'll wonder why he told her. It's a good 2.5 weeks before she sees him again. She's heading back to the dormitory to change her shoes with her dinner date, a senior, in tow, and it's just her luck that the boy she slept with twice now is heading out. As he passes, she has the impulse and temerity to brush her fingers against his stomach without her date noticing. He stiffens at the contact but doesn't look at her, his face blindly expressionless. She never promised him anything, she reminds herself, as she kicks off her stilettos back in her room. This doesn't banish the onset of something approaching pain, like she's been underwater for too long. Stupid girl, she tells herself, if only because she is one. When she's back downstairs with her date, she's silent as they walk. She thinks that what she's feeling might be guilt, but she's not completely sure. "No offense," she says suddenly, turning to the older boy, "but do you think we could just be friends?" Strictly, this nascent relationship isn't much of a sacrifice, considering she doesn't care much for this boy either way. It also doesn't change anything, but she does it anyway. Within another week, she learns that the boy she chose not to give up has been caught with pot. Stupid boy, she thinks, but there's indignation in there too, after she's told that the cops pinned him to the ground. "What the fuck did they do that for? He's this big around," she says, making a circle with her hands and waving it in her friend's face. Her friend looks at her blankly. She wonders whether she'll see him again, as she's always been a good child, at least as far as these things go, so she doesn't know what her university does to people who've been caught with pot. She's mildly surprised when she happens to see him walking around the quad where they live. He's too far away for her to catch his eye with ease, so she doesn't bother trying. The next day, she runs into him in the stairway. There's no one else there, so she wraps her arms around him, hiding her face in the crook of his neck. He's startled, but he hugs her back and she relaxes. "Are you mad at me?" she asks anyway, glancing upwards. "No, I'm not," he responds with a sideways smile, seeming almost surprised at the question. "I have to tell you something," he tells her sheepishly. "Do you mind if we go into my room?" She resists the urge to roll her eyes as she follows him. As it turns out, her university's policies lack enough on drug possession that he's not going where. Not this time, anyway. She's glad because it saves her the trouble of finding someone else. By now, they've established a routine, erratic as it is, as she straddles his hips and he slips his hands beneath her shirt. "You have really nice skin," he tells her appreciatively, his hands splayed across her stomach. She quirks the side of her mouth in a smile. He leans upward to grace her with brief puckering kisses, like a fish, and she turns away, laughing. They spend the afternoon beneath the dusty light that seeps through the blinds. It's early May, so they kick the covers to the corner of the bed, and she can see the soft shadows pouring into the dips of his bodies, from the slant of his shoulders to the line of his narrow hips. "Do you eat?" she murmurs, tracing the faint indents of ribs along his side. "I could ask you the same thing," he retorts gently. His fingers trail lazily up and down her back, occasionally tapping out scales. The warm air feels heavy against her exposed skin. His hand slowly stills, and she looks upwards to see that his eyes have drifted shut. However, she thinks of looming finals, so she drags herself off the bed, gingerly stretching a limb at a time over him towards the clothing discarded on the ground. She watches her struggle to hook the straps of her bra to place, the corners of his mouth tilted upwards. She casts him a narrowed-eyed look. When she's fully hooked and buttoned and zipped, she makes her way to the door, but pauses for a single clip beat, a stone ball rolling down the slope walls of her stomach. She sucks in a soundless breath, turns back two steps, and leans over to kiss him briefly on the mouth. Strands of hair slip off one shoulder to tap the corners of his face. One of her hands sinks into the mattress for balance while the other perches itself on his chest. The space between their mouths is shallow. She manages to evade his eyes as she leaves. Nothing more happens after this. She doesn't receive the final concluding note until they're packing printer, laundry basket, desk lamp into familiar cardboard boxes for the summer. At breakfast one day, her friend mentions that the boy left earlier that morning, guitar case in hand, after saying goodbye to the few hallmates who were somehow already awake. She shrugs as her fingers shred a biscuit, leaving the scraps scattered across her plate. She was still sleeping when he left. Later, she deletes his name and phone number from her cell phone because she doesn't have a use for them anymore. Half a year later, she meets him on the street as she's heading back to her apartment. She almost hopes they can go their respective ways without acknowledging each other, but he stares at her as she walks towards him. She thinks of all the debate tournaments in high school, being up for a round and struck by a feeling at the base of her throat more like terror than she'd admit. He greets her politely when she's close enough. They stop to talk, and she's easily just as polite as he is. "It's nice to see you," he tells her. "Don't say what you don't mean." She's caught off guard slightly about how brittle her voice comes out. Her functional sense of self-preservation, however, keeps her face impassive. He stares back, brows knitted, his mouth folded into a thin line. She watches things like words and accusations accumulate behind his bright blue eyes, but before he can open his mouth, she turns around and walks steadily away, like she's in no particular hurry. It's not very hard to do so, nor does he call her back. At the same time, she can't help but remember when she ran her tongue down the hollow of his throat and scraped her teeth against pale skin. He hissed and shuddered, the pads of his fingers digging beneath her shoulder blades. She remembers when he slid down for a kiss, his facial hair bristled against her mouth, and he shoved her lightly on the shoulder so she knew that he wanted to be on top, pressing against her, and he sucked on the ridge above her collarbone without ever making a mark. She always looked for one in the morning because she's dark-eyed and light-skinned, and she could still feel his mouth on her shoulder. He never seemed careful, but nothing was ever there. And every time there was relief, followed by the faintest tinge of what she thinks might have been disappointment.
Between man and his echo to argue that the impossibility of controlling the interpretation of one's voice creates irresolvable internal conflict between one's body and spirit. Man, a guilt-ridden elderly writer, goes to the bottom of a pit to reflect on his life and mentally prepare for death, but is distracted by his echo. Echo is presented as an individual separate voice rather than a possession or a derivative of man's voice. And man's inability to control echo parallels his inability to control how readers interpret his written work. Man wants to unite his spirit and body in order to die peacefully, but the disconnect between his voice and his echo prevents him from doing so. The poem ends abruptly when the cry of a stricken rabbit interrupts man's train of thought, causing him to lose the theme. The pitiful cry symbolizes man's helpless situation, and the final image of a confused and disoriented man emphasizes the fruitless nature of his efforts. The impossibility of controlling one's voice creates internal conflicts and prevents man from connecting with his spirit. While the irresolvable nature of these dualities makes efforts to mentally prepare oneself for death and the unification of body and spirit futile. The dialogue structure presents a conflicting duality between man and his voice and emphasizes man's lack of control over his voice. Man and Echo are presented as separate voices, and Echo's selective repetition of man's words alters their meaning and tone. For example, in the first stanza, man says, "Could my spoken words have checked that whereby a house lay wrecked, and all seems evil until I, sleepless wood, lie down and die." Echo only repeats, "lie down and die," taking man's words out of context and changing them from an expression of the difficulty of answering questions before death to a brisk command to die immediately. This change stresses the difficulty in controlling the interpretation of one's voice. Even repetition of one's words changes them. Echo's ability to alter the meaning of man's words by leaving out two key words, sleepless wood, hits potential ability of other people to change one's words, and emphasize the lack of control man has and how others interpret his voice. If man cannot control his own echo, how can he control other listeners? Man is just as powerless in controlling the interpretation of his written voice as he is in controlling the interpretation of his spoken one. As an author, he worries about the effects of his written work on readers. He asks, "Did that play of mine send out certain men the English shot? Did words of mine put too great strain on that woman's reeling brain? Could my spoken words have checked that whereby a house lay wrecked?" Man questions the effect of his written work on readers and is plagued with guilt for events that his work potentially caused. He worries that his words cause negative actions, such as inspiring men to go to war, and fail to cause positive actions, such as stopping a house from being wrecked. His unanswered questions, however, reflect the impossibility of knowing the effect of his words. His work could have motivated men to go to the English shot, but man has no way of knowing that it did. Regardless of how carefully man writes his words down, a reader's interpretation of these words can alter their intended meaning as easily as echo alters his spoken voice. Perhaps then man's feelings of responsibility are not justified, and this is what Echo is trying to tell him when he says, "lie down and die," and into the night. Man shouldn't worry so much about his voice because he has no way of knowing to what extent he's responsible for anything. Instead, he should accept death peacefully. Man finds Echo's advice to accept death throughout the poem, reflecting the rift between his physical self and his voice and spirit created by the inability to control the interpretation of his voice. The dialogue format of the poem and the inherent qualities of an echo draw attention to this disconnect. For example, an echo has a different sound than the voice it came from. Whether faint and muffled or throaty and whispery, an echo is different than its parent voice, which may explain why man responds to his rocky voice as if it were another person, instead of ignoring it as a reverberation of his own voice. Man derives meaning from Echo's words and responds to them, and Echo influences the direction and topic of man's words. For example, after Echo says, "lie down and die," man says, that were to shirk the spiritual intellect's great work. He explains he cannot lie down and die yet because he needs to clean his dirty sleep. Instead of ignoring the echo, man feels the need to justify his actions and explain himself. Whereas in the first stanza, the man reflected upon his own life, the echo's advice to lie down and die launches man into an explanation of why man cannot die until they have awakened their spiritual intellect and reflected upon their lives. Man's thought process broadens from his individual situation to mankind in general. For example, he says, "While man cannot still his body keep, wine or love drug him to sleep. Waking he thanks the Lord that he, his body and its stupidity." This change in course reflects the power of Echo's words and demonstrates man's treatment of his echo as a separate voice. It also highlights man's avoidance of the task at hand. He can't stress enough the importance of reflection and introspection before death, but just talking about it is not the same as actually going through the process. The implication of man's failure to act upon what he advocates is so important is that he does not want to undergo this process, but rather, as his own voice tells him in the form of an echo, lie down and die. This suggests that echo is not separate from man at all, but rather represents his subconscious desires. Is echo really a separate voice, or is echo a part of man? Man's interaction with Echo suggests that Echo is a separate entity, with the setting in a stony cave and the fact that Echo only repeats what man says suggests that Echo is nothing more than an echo. If Echo is just a reverberation of man's words, then the only meaning behind Echo's words is the meaning that man superimposes upon them. Man thinks that Echo is commanding him to lie down and die, only because he inserts this meaning into Echo's words. Without this interpretation, Echo's words are hollow and meaningless, as are man's words. One's voice is worthless until someone hears and interprets it. As an author, man is aware, however, of the tendency of an audience's interpretation to change one's voice with a meaning different than what the author intended. Thus, a person can only be in control of his voice when he is alone, a fact which man is aware of, based on the remote setting of the poem. The poem's setting in an isolated cave reflects man's effort to control the consequences of his voice. Each opening line brings man farther away from the people who would hear his words and change their intended meaning. Not only is man in a cleft, but he's also under broken stone and at the bottom of a pit that broad noon has never lit. Man has taken great lengths to be alone and avoid the risk of having his words heard and manipulated. His retreat into a deep, dark, isolated cave reflects his desire to introspect and connect with the spirit, but he cannot expect the implications of his voice. Man confesses his secrets to the stone that cannot change his words, but man's own echo betrays him, or does it? Perhaps Echo is trying to help man by offering advice. If Echo is just an echo, perhaps man's selective hearing of Echo's words represent a repressed desire to give in to death without dealing with the reflection his guilt-ridden mind thinks is necessary. Regardless of Echo's role in the poem, the juxtaposition between Echo's short, simple lines with man's lengthy stanzas draws attention to Echo's words. On a visual level, the reader's eye is immediately drawn to Echo's short lines because they stand out against man's large chunks of dialogue. Echo's terse, simple lines are the most memorable of the entire poem because of their placement. They interrupt the rhythm and rhyme of man's thoughts. For example, the first stanza follows a regular A-B-B rhyme scheme, and Echo's line is an additional A line where a B is expected. The regular rhythm and rhyme of the first stanza lends to a sing-songy feel that is abruptly interrupted by Echo's line. This interruption highlights the lack of control man has over how his voice is used and interpreted. Each of man's lines is carefully structured, and he does not rush or trip over his words, but he cannot do anything about his voice reverberating off the walls. Echo interrupts him twice, both times encouraging him to give in to death immediately. The reader is tempted to trust Echo more than man, as Echo's short, simple lines are the only answers to man's dilemma presented in the poem. Man's nervous questions and rambling is insecure, while Echo's simple lines are sure and comfortable. While man harps on the importance of making sure that all is arranged in one clear view and judging one's soul, he never presents the reader with a way of doing this, and he himself never goes through the process. On the other hand, Echo's advice to lie down and die and go into the night is simple and straightforward. In lieu of man's unanswered questions and unresolved conflicts, Echo's advice makes sense. The rabbit cry at the end of the poem symbolizes the hopelessness of man's efforts to either control his voice or to connect his body and spirit. Just before man is interrupted by the rabbit, he asks, "O rocky voice, shall we in that great night rejoice? What do we know that we face one another in this place?" Man finally realizes and confronts the rift between his body and voice and begs to feel some connection with it, but Echo does not reply with a comforting reassurance of their connection, and man forgets what he's been talking about when the rabbit cries out. This pathetic cry is the uninspiring answer to man's queries. The helpless rabbit being attacked by a bird of prey is a symbol of man's hopeless situation. Just as it is impossible for the rabbit to escape the hawk, man will never be able to rejoice with his voice and forever view the world in sets of dualities. The irony of man's dialogue and the impossibility of ever resolving the mind-body dilemma suggests that death is a mystery that cannot be mentally prepared for. Rather, one must submit to death naturally. Man's inability to find a way to reflect and introspect, as well as Echo's straightforward advice to simply give in to death, support this idea. Man's inner conflicts and the disconnect between his body and spirit are the results of the impossibility of controlling the interpretation of his voice. It is impossible to control how other people interpret and apply meaning to one's words, and therefore, once words leave a speaker's body, they are no longer in his control, but are dependent on the listener's interpretation. Unfortunately, the only way to possibly maintain control over one's voice would be to remain in isolation and never talk to anyone, which we see man try to do unsuccessfully. Perhaps then this is Yeats' way of encouraging his readers to not be afraid of using their voices. His use of the name man suggests a global audience as well as man's discussion of mankind. Perhaps this poem is Yeats' call to many to forget their unjustified guilt and use their voices freely.
I have a question. they were all brilliant papers, all three of them, different in all sorts of ways, voice, subject matter, but brilliant, all three. I'm wondering if each one of the three of you could talk a little bit about, for lack of a better term, the creative process. And really, I'm in writing these papers, and I'm shamelessly asking the question for my own anecdotal file, because I'll have students sitting in my office who are trying to actually figure out the moment where an idea comes into focus in your mind, but then you begin to actually make the transition to putting it down to paper. And of course, there are as many answers to that question as there are writers in the world. I understand that. So I'm wondering if each one of the three of you might be willing to talk out loud just a little bit about the moment when this paper started coming together, and where the idea came from, and how it was written.
Yeah, I think for me, I didn't start off with the exact thesis that I ended up with. It's definitely a longer process. But I think for me, in the beginning, it's just a lot of brainstorming, and then sometimes even do periods too. And from that, I look back and see if I can, if there's, you know, give me an idea that I can pull from that. And then even after that, a lot of revising. So I think just being willing to go back and change things and realizing that it's a very flexible process that evolves, I think that's an important process. Just being willing to like revise and everything.
Yeah.
Okay, sure.
For me, it's a little bit different because it's creative writing. I always feel that it's important that you not go in with the idea of necessarily like what you want to write. Like, you can't really be too strict with it. And my thing is, like, I'll write from either like a feel, a particular feeling or a scene. And I never start at the beginning to go directly to the end. I'll find something that particularly inspires me, and like I run outwards from it, kind of like an ink blot that just kind of spreads outwards. And then eventually when I have enough of those, I go back through and try to connect the dots and rearrange them into like a coherent narrative. And that's how I sort of think about it.
And for me, the reason I kind of had this topic was I looked at all the prompts that we were given, and this was the one that not only was the most interesting, but probably like, at least for me, like the most confusing. So I really had to like sit down and grapple with it and try and come up with the most familiar essay that I could. And I really, one of the things that I did kind of, and she was just talking before me, I saw one part of the poem that really interested me, which was the breaking up into sections, and kind of with each section, it kind of paralleled something else in the music. So I really wanted to make that distinction between the two. So I guess for me, just finding just the one interesting thing and then developing an essay around that one interesting thing is how this essay came.
Could I follow up and ask how long it took each one of you to actually write it? The number of hours or days or whatnot? I mean, since there's absolutely nothing writing on the line here, it's an entirely innocent question, at least in the phrase.
I know that we and I were in the same class, and we had to do like two drafts. So I think that was over 2 weeks. This is the second essay, but I don't know if that was for you, but for me, yeah, it was the second essay, and I know that it took me a lot longer to do the first essay, but I think that after doing that, I sort of developed more skills, so I was able to sort of put this together more quickly, because it was sort of more confident in the first one.
Because Haley and I were in the same class, this was my second essay also, but one of the interesting things about this essay was like, the whole second half of this essay has nothing to do with like the first draft that I presented. So like it kind of took, like I had to like rewrite a lot of it. So I would say like it was like a week of actually like going back and intensely looking through it and everything like that, because I just kind of changed from what I originally thought it was going to be. So
awesome. And I think the original comment
want to be done, or just, I mean, like, anytime we had time, like, anytime anything came up in my head, like, I just wrote down a notebook and write it down. So I'm not exactly sure how long it took, but as far as revising goes, I think it probably, I think about the same process. Like, I'll look over it in little bits of time over, like, a week or so. And so I guess altogether, like, 3 weeks of my life.
A question. I think you keep dominating the audience question, but let me, can I again, it's sort of out of anecdotal file interests. So I'm in an upper division history honor seminar where people are actually writing honors theses, and we have been reading a book, a little book by a woman named Annie Dillard called The Writing Life. I don't know if anybody knows that, but it's really just filled with metaphors about writing, and most of them actually about the terror of writing, writer's block, and procrastination, and all. It's a little bit actually to read, especially if you're a writer. And it provoked a discussion about what were all these history majors who were contemplating the terror of having to write a thesis, really, this at the end of junior year, and it extends over all of senior. What were they supposed to do with this book about Annie Dillard and the writing life? One student actually, at one point, I was saying, I knew I was going to be spending a lot of time writing, but I never really thought I was going to have a writing life to, in fact, do this. It provoked a conversation about where people wrote and with what they wrote. And one person at the table, she actually went on to become a history professor, actually related to the utter consternation of everyone else at the table that her computer was her friend. And everyone else looked at her as if she was completely daft, because that was the last thing they thought of her computer, particularly at this time of year where there's so many deadlines and so much going on and so much chaos. So I guess I kind of ask you, as blossoming writers, and certainly sitting up at this table makes you blossoming writers, about your relationship with the task itself of writing. Is it something that you run to because you love it? Is it something that terrorizes you because it's a, I'm speaking personally, for me, I sit down and oftentimes it's a task. It's something, if I actually make it, I forget the task, it's actually wonderful, but it's infrequent that I do that. Could you talk about, you know, your relationship with, would you be the sort of person that says, yes, oh, I love my laptop, I love being with it, and writing on it, and having it tell the story?
Yeah, I think
Would you care to comment on how you would have contributed to that discussion on the seminar table?
I think it depends. It depends on the assignment. It depends on the class. Sometimes I feel like I have a really good understanding of, you know, what this is going to be about, so it's sort of not a big deal. But if, you know, if you're up against something that is confusing to you or that seems very difficult or is, you know, very long, so that's back, that might be intimidating. But I think I found, for me, just trying to start early, which is difficult, but like the earlier I start, the better. And if I do start early, that gives me time to like revise and sort of think about ideas more. So I started out sort of like this inner battle, like trying to make yourself, you know, start early even if you don't want to. And that shows things with me again.
You have to make a distinction between all the classes.
Like, once again, I'm a creative writing teacher. And as far as like analytical writing go, I kind of hate it. I avoid it if I can. And so, like, I like my free writer. I don't have to write much of anything. But at the same time, like, for creative writing, I feel like it's like a pet. Like, I have these ideas that will germinate, like, over a really long period of time that I know I'll. Like Hemingway wrote once, it's the things you save to write when you learn when you can write well. And they're like little things that gnaw at your ankles, and eventually you will give in and write them. And like I had, I'm in an advanced fiction workshop right now, and the first story I wrote was one of those things that like, it's one of those ideas that I've been sort of tossing around for a long time. And as far as like computers go, I actually write by hand. I always write by first draft. In like a little moleskin by hand in my like tiny little cricket writing. And then eventually when I go, and that's when they're never in order, like little paragraph here, little paragraph there. And then eventually when I put them into order, I type them up in the computer. And that's how I eventually get a hard copy down.
I'm like someone when I'm writing my first draft, I do it all by hand. So I just like writing by first time, but I definitely like have it in order. And then Rebecca's probably the nature of the writing is more analytical, but when I try and write something that's more like analysis based, which is most of the writing that I do, I'm trying to analyze something. I try and make it as enjoyable for me and the reader. So I usually go like to Panera or to Starbucks to like chill out, and like that's where I go and like I write my first draft or something like that, because if I'm like not having fun writing it, then it's gonna like show up. But you learn to tell it wasn't a pain for me to write it. And then when I'm actually like doing the actual writing, I want to make it so, like even if like this is for my English class, like this paper was, I want it to be something that's pretty enjoyable for someone else to read. Like if they're just looking through my essays and just like, hey, this is something that she wrote. It's actually, I might not know the poem, but I like the way it sounds. I like the argument she's making. So I try to make it something enjoyable for other people to read if they're not like experts in their area. So that's kind of how I take it. So I guess I would say that the writing process is more fun for me in general.
It's like Tetris. Like you have little pieces and they fit perfectly. Like
this leads to this, leads to this, leads to this. And it's not like, it's not expected, like either one. It's just, but after you go through and read it, it makes complete sense. And like the way you take apart the poems and then put it into your art. And also, I think you're a really good reader, like just reading it out loud.
Well, with Haley, just like, we were in the same class, so it was like when she was going through her poem, I was like, yeah, I totally agree with that. Like, because like, I was like familiar with the poem, so it was just like, I don't know, it was kind of cool to, even though I haven't like reread the poem forever, but it was just kind of cool to see the argument and then like the logical flow of it. And I don't know, you brought up an interesting point about how the poem paralleled something that like Yeats was saying. I hadn't looked at it that way before, so it was, I really appreciated that. And then with your short story, I really, really liked it. Like, I was just chilling over here, like, listening to you. And it was, like, it was a really good short story, so I hope you continue with that, because you're quite good. So, I liked it a lot.
Now you have to explain what you're doing.
I was curious too, this was an assignment, but could you, I don't know if Martini has read the story. But have you all been interested in poetry before or done this kind of analysis? yes, no.
I'm just laughing because like, I seriously, like when I started this class, I was like, I hate poetry so much. Like, I just didn't really enjoy poetry, but like when I started to see like some of the different things that the nuances that poetry had, I mean that poetry could be like not just ridiculous and out there, but actually like applicable to something, then I started to like enjoy it more. But it was just funny because going to the class, I was like, I hate poetry. I don't want poems ever.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it wasn't like an introduction poetry class, it was one of those like, but it, like for, I think I chose to do, like, we had several options for the prompts, but I think for all of them, I chose to do it.
So yeah, I think it was.
It was. I know poems too. So.
Do you, and what do you, well, like, I'm interested in your poetry collection. What else?
I actually do write a bit of poetry because at the same time I took the beginning fiction workshop, I was taking the beginning poetry workshop. And I'm not sure what I think about poetry. For the most part, I'm not entirely sure if I like it, but I'm not entirely sure that I dislike it.
Any final questions? Yes. We'll have another selection of panels starting at 4:30, I think it's about 4:15, a little after. And then after that, there'll be concluding remarks here in this room. And then I believe there's a reception, right? At the Mexican buffet, I don't know, sounds delicious. Mm-hmm. So please go over your guide and see what you might like to see next. But thank you all very much.